couple weeks ago, Jeff had called and said, what do you plan on preaching? And I had given him a couple of passages, neither of which was 1 Peter chapter 1. And I told my wife this morning, I said, I realized that the nature of this morning's message was, if I can use a single word, it would simply be, it was heavy. That particular passage carries weight with it. And I think purposely and understandably so. Peter was talking to a group of individuals that were going through a troublesome and dark time. So I appreciate your patience in allowing me to work through it within the context of my own heart and within the context of my own mind, recognizing once again that God is sovereign, that God is good, and that we can rejoice in that. And thus, I've enjoyed not just being here ministering the word, but even our time of musical worship before that, which reminds us all of those truths so that we can carry them with us through the course of this week. Now, this evening, I'm going to give you a little bit of a listening strategy, because this evening we're going to do something distinctly different than what we did this morning. Instead of taking a New Testament text and walking through it with the details of it, we're actually going to do a story, and then that story will culminate in some applications, some lessons from the marketplace, with what this really looks like as far as life is concerned. My primary focus, actually, this evening, I want to tie it in with the song which we both sang this morning congregationally, and then which was played for us beautifully this evening, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. If you know anything about that song, the story behind it, at least the author behind it, Robert Robinson, was an individual who had, shall we say, fluctuations within his own heart as it relates to his relationship with God. There are times when he was at great spiritual highs, and during those times, he again would write songs similar to what was played for us this evening. But then there were other times when he would have tremendous lows, times of depression, seemingly times of silence from God. And thus, when we get to that third verse, when it says, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love, that was very much a personal testimony on his behalf. Matter of fact, the story is told that he was actually riding on a train in England, and as he was really straying from the Lord within the context of his own heart, there was an individual sitting across from him, and the very song at which we sang, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, had been published in a London newspaper. The individual sitting across from him on the train began to read that poem as it was published aloud, not knowing who he was. And as she was reading the lyrics to him, he began to weep uncontrollably. And obviously, she didn't know the context for this emotional outburst. And he simply looked at her and said, I am the one who is prone to wander. I am the one who has not heard from God. Let me ask a question this evening. And the question is simply this. Have there ever been times in your life when God has seemingly been silent? When you've asked for his direct input within your life, where you're looking for his hand to move in a way that is noticeable, that is almost tangible, just for that sense of security that God indeed does care, that he is sovereign, that he is in control, I would dare say that anyone sitting in this congregation has had that experience before. You've had those times when God seemingly is silent. What I'd like to do again this evening is tell a story, and I'm going to actually put the story in a 21st century context. And as I tell the story within a 21st century context, if you can begin to identify its biblical context, feel free to turn to that particular story. And then at the end of really placing it within a modern context, we want to delve into it from a biblical perspective. Walk through the hand of God moving within the life of a single individual, again, with a goal of deriving truths at the end that would be an encouragement for us this evening. The story actually begins with an individual, a young lady in her late 20s, and her name is Rosa. Rosa was from Mexico and actually from a very poor family. She did not grow up with any great privileges or any great opportunities. The reality is she was just a hard worker. Rosa, like anyone, had dreams. She wanted to be something, wanted to be somebody, wanted obviously to have a family, children, etc., like any young girl growing up would have. She ultimately wanted to meet a nice young man and just be normal. Well, at 18, she met a nice young man. His name was Kyle. Kyle was from the United States. His family had moved to Mexico for work and for food. His father, unfortunately, died almost right away upon their landing in Mexico. But his mother kept the family there because she, from her perspective, really didn't have any other place to go. Kyle was not particularly good looking. His family, like Rosa's, was relatively poor. He struggled with sickness, but Kyle loved Rosa, and she in turn loved him. So they got married. For 10 years, they lived together in Mexico with his family. When Kyle was healthy, he was a farmhand. When he was sick, then she would work to support them. The 10 years of marriage were good, but they were also hard. They were hard particularly because Kyle and Rosa tried to have children, but seemingly they could never get over the hump of barrenness. Days, weeks, months, years passed. For Rosa, this weight of barrenness was particularly painful. For in her culture, not having a child was a sign of curse, was not a sign of blessing at any level. So of all the pains that she felt, barrenness was indeed the deepest of them all. Hope deferred did make her heart sick. But she had Kyle, a loving husband, a supportive man, and his family loved her. As Kyle and Rosa moved into their 11th year of marriage, Kyle got sick after harvest. Well, this was not particularly unusual, but this time the cough lasted a little bit longer and sounded a little bit deeper. The fever rose quickly and did not subside. On day 4, doctors were summoned. By day 7, Kyle's body was like a furnace. Nothing could cool him down. By day 9, Kyle lost consciousness. By day 12, he was dead. On day 14, Rosa buried him. At 18, Rosa had bright hopes for her future. She desired a normal life in which her dreams were fulfilled. And unfortunately, at age 28, she woke up seemingly experiencing a nightmare. She had no money, no children, and again, she just buried her husband. All was lost. Now her closest friend, Kyle's mother, whose name was Nancy, was now leaving her. Nancy had become a bitter, frustrated woman. She buried her husband, and ultimately she buried her 2 boys. And from her perspective, God was doing battle with her, and that battle was an unfair battle. Nancy knew that indeed she had lost. So Nancy packed the few belongings that she had and headed back across the border into Batesville, Texas. Her faithful daughter-in-law, Rosa, followed. Really bereft of Kyle, Rosa really had nowhere else to go. Upon arriving in Batesville, a family member allowed them to stay in the room above the garage. Family really couldn't provide any food for them, but the room was theirs as long as they needed it. It was harvest time, middle of August. Temperatures outside were around 100, inside about 90. Nancy and Rosa had nothing. Unfortunately, Nancy really seemed too depressed even to care. So Rosa knew that she had to do something. One morning, she arose, asking Nancy's permission to go out and to seek some level of employment, to get something by way of possessions, money, so that she could feed the family. Yet at the same time, she was an immigrant, a foreigner, and thus really it was illegal for her to work within the area. But she could go to the highway. So with bag in hand, she handed to the highway with a goal of picking up cans. It wasn't necessarily good money, but she believed that she could make enough money so that day by day they could survive. When she got to the freeway, she noticed that she was not alone. Matter of fact, several were making their living by picking up cans. The locals had claimed their own territory because cans indeed were valuable. For some family, those cans were life. Thus, she was shuffled really from one location to another location, at times even forcefully. Finally, she came to a portion of the freeway that seemed profitable. She asked one of the men working in that section if she could join them, and he hesitantly agreed as long as she stayed behind the other workers and only picked up what they had missed. Well, she agreed. At 18, Rosa had dreamed of a good life. Now she was picking up cans in the heat of the day on foreign soil. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. With that 21st century introduction, let's go back to the biblical story and let's put the names behind it that the scriptures supply. Turn with me to Ruth chapter 2. In Ruth chapter 2, we pick up the story of Rosa, or the story of Ruth. A foreigner, bereft of everything, now on foreign soil, looking for something to supply food for herself and for her mother-in-law, Naomi. Now, this particular chapter obviously has to be placed within the larger context of the book of Ruth. Many times when we think of the story of Ruth or the book of Ruth, we always imagine Ruth to be the primary character within the story. And I would suggest for us this evening that Ruth is actually not the primary character. That the primary character in the book of Ruth is Naomi. This is a story of Naomi's battle with God. Indeed, she had left Bethlehem, Judah, had gone to the country of Moab during a time of famine in the days of the judges when every man was doing what was right in his own eyes. And in that country of Moab, she indeed had lost her husband, Elimelech, and her two children, Chilion and Mahlon. Two daughter-in-laws she loved, but only one followed her, only one that loved her to the point of death. And again, that was Ruth. But from Naomi's perspective, really the blinders of bitterness had caused her not even to recognize the blessing of Ruth. If you'll look with me in chapter 1, as she returns to Bethlehem, the women of the city call out to her as she returns, "Is this Naomi?" And in verse 20, she responds, and she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" From Naomi's perspective, God owed her protection, owed her provision, owed her progeny, a family line. And yet she had none of these things. She came back, using her words, she came back empty. Yet isn't it interesting that even as she says, "I've come back empty," there's actually someone who's standing right beside her. That individual standing beside her is Ruth, the Moabitess. You have to stop and imagine for a moment what Ruth felt like at that moment. Here's Naomi lifting up her hands and saying, "I went out full and I came back empty." And here's poor Ruth standing beside her, simply looking at this crowd of women saying, "Hello, my name's empty. I'm the one that came back. I have nothing to offer." And yet in chapter 2, we see God's provision for Naomi in at least the first two areas, that of protection and that of provision. And then finally in chapter 3, we have in 3 and 4, we have the story of God's provision of Naomi, of progeny, of family line. So this is a story of a woman's battle with God who believes God has treated her unfairly. But couched within this story is the narrative of Ruth, the Moabitess. As we begin our story in chapter 2, we see that it's really broken up into four different scenes. Let me just outline them for you. The first scene is verses 1 through 3, where Ruth really enters into the workplace. The second scene is the report of the foreman, which is in verses 4 through 7. Verses 8 through 17 is the third scene. This is the response of Boaz. And then finally, there's a fourth scene, and that fourth scene is in verses 18 through 23, which is the report back to Naomi. If you'll allow me just to walk through the story, and I want to make sure that as we walk through the story that we span the bridge from their town to our town so that we understand what is happening within the context of the story. Then again, we'll draw out principles or lessons for the marketplace at the end. The curtain goes up in Act 2 of the book of Ruth, chapter 1 being Act 1. As the curtain goes up, Naomi and Ruth are sitting within the home. In verse 2, Ruth begins by asking, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after the one whose sight I may find favor." So what Ruth is asking for is the opportunity to glean. This, according to the Mosaic law, was a legal process. Matter of fact, it was not only legal, it was an act of grace on behalf of God. Those within the community that could not provide for themselves, and even foreigners from outside the Israelite community, were allowed to glean after those that were the maidservants. And again, most of us understand the story here, but allow me just to demonstrate what's happening. Within the field, there would be a line of maidservants that would be crossing the field, and they would be cutting down the harvest and loading the grain up within their own baskets. Standing back behind them, probably somewhere in the realm of 5 to 10 yards, would be a group of poor individuals and foreigners. And they were told that they could pick up any of the grain, any of the corn, any of the wheat that was left behind. Now again, God in his grace actually encouraged maidservants as they were moving forward and doing the initial harvest to not stop and to turn around. In other words, if they missed something as they were going through the line, the Mosaic law commanded them to leave it there. Provision for those that were poor. So what Ruth was asking for was legally acceptable. But there was a challenge with this. And the challenge was, and it's even identified in verse 2, that Ruth was a Moabitess. As a matter of fact, through the totality of this chapter, she's always defined via her ethnic identity. And again, we won't take the time to go back through the story of the Exodus, but we know that the Moabites were no friends of Israel. They were of the offspring of the incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter. They were those that actually tried to hire a prophet to curse Israel, Balaam, who failed in his cursing of Israel. And when he failed to do that, ultimately what King Balak of the Moabites did is he sent the Moabite women into the camp of Israel to commit fornication with the men of Israel, and by doing so, in some way curry favor or gain allegiance. And Moses' response to that and God's response to that was being hot with anger. So much so that even within the Mosaic law in Deuteronomy, Moses says that the Moabites have no place within the children of Israel. So, as Ruth goes out, she's not just simply an unknown foreigner. She's a Moabite. A woman known by race for their sensuality and known by law as having no part within the children of Israel. But she goes anyway, picking it up again in verse 3. At the end of verse 2, actually. Naomi responds, "Go, my daughter." So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. So we have our first scene. Within the construct of our first scene, Ruth goes out, and as she's walking through the fields, again, it's important for us to understand a little bit of the ancient Near Eastern context. All the people in the city would be gathered in homes in a protective formation so that all the farmers' fields would have been outside of the city. And those would have been marked merely by stones. And as Ruth is going out and eyeing one field and another field, the writer communicates in a very ambiguous way that she just happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. She's walking down the path, identifying the stones. She walks into a particular field. And thus we have the end of really the first scene. Ruth takes initiative. There's a second scene that's given for us, and that begins in verse 7. Now Boaz enters into the scene. Verse 4. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." Verse 5, and Boaz said to his servants, to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant in charge of the reapers answered and said, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab." Notice the emphasis of her ethnic diversity. Verse 7, and she said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. And she's been sitting in the house for a little while. So our second scene, verses 4 through 7, is really the report of the foreman. Let me just note three things. Number one, he communicates that she asked permission before entering the field, something that was legally not necessary, but something, again, that she did. Second, he notes that she's been working since the early morning, an individual who obviously was industrious by character and by nature. And then there's that last little phrasing, and that last little phrase, as it's translated within the New American Standard, it simply says that she's been sitting in the house for a little while. That phrase is very difficult to translate. Various English translations will communicate it in diverse ways. Some is communicated that she's pausing to take a rest. Others will communicate that she's beginning to leave the field. I would suggest, and I'll see if I can validate this in just a moment, that indeed Ruth had probably stopped working and was edging her way to another field. She was about ready to leave Boaz's lot at that point, or his plot at that point. Third scene, Boaz responds. Seemingly, Boaz goes over to Ruth and begins to communicate individually to her. Verse 8, and Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." I want you to note Boaz's instructions. Matter of fact, there are four instructions that he gives to Ruth. The first one is simply this: do not go and glean in another field. Matter of fact, he says it twice. Do not go from here. All right, this is an imperative, and this is why I would suggest that Ruth was probably beginning to leave the field, and Boaz's response is, don't go. Second, he simply says, I want you to stick close to my servant girls. In other words, the distance that a gleaner would stay from the maids, Boaz is closing that distance. I want you to stay close. I want you to get the good grain. I want you to watch the field where my men are harvesting. In other words, know the boundaries. Move up close. Know the boundaries. Third thing that he says, follow after my men, because I have ordered them not to touch you or not to mistreat you. again, we need to understand the significance of this command because it's not given only once. Go down with me to verses 15 and 16 in Ruth chapter 2. Once again, Boaz gives instructions now to his men. He says, when she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servant, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and note what he says, and do not insult her. And also, you shall purposely pull out some of your grain from the bundles and leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her. Go with me to verse 22. Now we have the words of Naomi. Naomi's instructions to Ruth, where she says, and Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids, lest others fall upon you in another field. Sometimes we miss the significance of what Ruth was doing here and really the danger that was involved in it. Again, I'll remind you, this is the time of the judges. Every man is doing what's right in his own eyes. She's a Moabite. Many would suggest that Boaz's instructions to his men, were he was actually stopping what had already taken place. It's actually interesting, this concept of not insulting her. It could also be translated, don't hiss at her. If we were to put this in a 21st century context, you could almost imagine the girl in the back walking by and picking up the grain, and the servant men are turning around, and there's catcalls that are taking place. There's whistling that is taking place. Suggestive language begins to pour out of their mouth. And now Boaz puts an end to that. And Naomi says, you stay in that field for your own safety's sake. And then finally, there's a fourth command that Boaz communicates. And the fourth command is simply this. You drink the water that my men will draw for you. You drink the water that my servants are drinking. And again, we need to understand the significance of this. The well within Bethlehem would have been in city proper. It would not have been out in the field. And thus the men probably would have drawn water early in the morning and brought it out for themselves with an expectation that the gleaners were responsible for their own water. Certainly, no Israelite would draw water for a Moabite, and no man would draw water for a woman. Yet I can't help but think that Boaz is communicating to his servants, you have made fun of her in the past, now she will drink of your water. He was adding a little bit of protection for Ruth's sake. But Boaz's grace does not stop there. Not only is there provision for her employment, there's also words of affirmation for her position. Let's continue our reading. Verse 10. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? And Boaz answered and said to her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and come to a people that you did not know previously. Verse 12, may the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Then she said, I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. I want you to note for a moment what's happening here. Ruth is making a progression in position within the eyes of Boaz. She's noted early in the chapter as a foreigner, and she notes herself as such in verse 6. She is a complete outsider to the community. Then she becomes a gleaner, in essence, a poor insider within the community. Then in verse 9, she goes from a gleaner to a favored gleaner. Move up close to my gals. And then Boaz's instructions to his own servants. You let her stay close and you drop sheaves on purpose for her. So she's gone from a foreigner to a gleaner, to a favored gleaner, then to a lowly servant. She says, I'm a maidservant. I thought I was a foreigner. Matter of fact, I am a foreigner. But Boaz, you're treating me as one of your own. But again, it doesn't stop there. Let's continue our reading, verse 14. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here, that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. Again, note the graciousness of Boaz's actions. He says, come here, which indicates that she probably separated herself from the locals, per se, off eating by herself. Eat the bread. This was the bread that was prepared for the laborers. Dip it in the vinegar. Feel free to use the condiments. Matter of fact, let me give you some of the roasted grain. And the term that's used here speaks of a delicacy, something that Boaz seized from others and gave to her. And not only did he give her enough for daily satisfaction, but she had leftovers. We read later on in this story that she actually took those leftovers and, in our terms, put them in a little doggy bag and took them home to her mother-in-law, Naomi. She says, this man has dealt graciously with me. Again, let's go back and look at the progression. She's moved from a foreigner to a gleaner, to a favored gleaner, to a lowly servant. Now she is a favored servant. She's sitting beside the boss. And he's feeding her. Then, as we already saw in verses 16 and 17, now she's given additional benefits. And Ephah, she picks up, verse 17. So she gleaned in the field unto evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was an ephah of barley. And ephah is roughly about 22 liters. If she were to pick up an ephah on a daily basis, she would have enough food to provide for both herself and for Naomi for the totality of a year. Ruth goes from nothing to something in the matter of minutes. There's a final scene, and the final scene is simply her report back to her mother-in-law, verse 18. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? And where did you work? May he be blessed, or may he who took notice of you be blessed. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the name of the man with whom I worked is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and the dead. And again, Naomi said to her, the man is our relative. He is one of our closest relatives. Verse 21, then Ruth the Moabite said, furthermore, he said to me, you should stay close to my servants until they have finished all of my harvest. Let me skip down to verse 23. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. A day in the life of Ruth. We just experienced it. Now, the question for us this evening is simply this. What are we to do with this story? How does this impact our life in 2019? What are the principles that we can draw from it? And I really want to go back to our first question. How do we respond when God is seemingly silent? I think there are three simple lessons we can learn from this story. Lesson number one would be this. God's sovereignty and man's initiative are not in tension. God's sovereignty and man's initiative are not in tension. We should never formulate our understanding of God's providence in such a way that human responsibility fades away. Matter of fact, I would add to that simply that God's sovereignty does not eliminate our freedom. It actually creates it. It's within the boundaries of God's sovereignty, within the boundaries of his providence, that allows us to move and to work because we have the promise that he will be there with us. Verse 1, Ruth saw a need. Verse 2, she had the strength to meet it. Verse 3, she had the legal rights to go out. And she did so. So what does this look like in our life? Have you ever felt so paralyzed in the way that God was leading you that you never knew what to do next? Has there ever been a time in your life where you've simply said, Lord, I just don't know where to go. I just don't know what to do. If you would just write it in the skies, then it would be clear for me. Because everything right now just seems so foggy. Everything just seems so distant at that point in time. There are singles that at times will say, Lord, I would love to have a spouse. I'd love to be married. So if you could just write his or her name in the sky, that would be great. Or perhaps we do something like this, which I must admit that I did when I was in college. Lord, whoever's wearing a red sweater today, that's the one I'll pursue. And then, of course, you see the first one in a red sweater and you go, well, Lord, maybe it's the blue sweater. Maybe that's what I was looking for. I'm sure that's what I was looking for at that point in time. Sometimes we can be so mystical in our understanding of how God leads. Can I simply say this? Ruth provides a wonderful example to us of how to take the next step when God's will is seemingly foggy within the construct of our life. And the next step is this: just do the next right thing. Take the responsibility for the step that is directly in front of you. Take that step and trust the Lord for the next step. This is not a standalone lesson just bound within the book of Ruth. We find even Abraham's slave, or servant, Eliezer, as he goes forth to look for a wife for Isaac. And he simply uses these words, and it's within the authorizing. I love the way the King James puts it, where Eliezer simply says, I being in the way, the Lord led me. David phrases it like this in Psalm 37. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delights in his way. Though he fall, he will not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholds him with his hands. Sometimes we can get so paralyzed, so confused, so distraught over two ideas. Number one is this terminology of finding God's will. Can I suggest for us this evening that we do not need to find God's will because it was never lost? You do not find God's will, you follow God's will. God's will is communicated to us with absolute clarity within the boundaries of his decreed word. How do I know what is the right thing to do? Well, I read my Bible. And because I love him, I obey it. And as I obey the word of God, as I take the next step that is in front of me, as I do the right thing, I can have absolute confidence in the sovereignty and in the providence of God that as I take the right step, God will meet me there. And that God's, what we define at times as his secret will, his unknown will, is revealed to us as we faithfully do his decreed will. What did Ruth do? She simply fulfilled her responsibilities. She took initiative. She took the next step. So sometimes we get frustrated with this idea of finding God's will. And I'll simply say, God's a father who has not hid his will from us. He's a father who declares it to us every day within the parameters of his word. The second term that at times will cause paralyzation or constraint within our heart is this idea of waiting upon the Lord. When we phrase it within our English perspective, waiting communicates a sense of inactivity. All right, so what am I doing right now? Well, I'm not doing anything. Well, why aren't you doing anything? Well, I'm waiting on the Lord. Can I suggest again that as this phrase, waiting on the Lord, is used within the context of the scriptures, it never connotes inactivity. Matter of fact, when I was pastoring, I was in a home Bible study, and I asked the group, I said, what does it mean to wait upon the Lord? And a little five-year-old boy threw his hand up in the air. His name was Spencer. And I saw his little hand, and I kind of smiled, and I was waiting for an adult to respond, and he kept going, you know, Pastor Brian, I know. I said, all right, Spencer, what does it mean to wait on the Lord? And he said, you know what? He said, my family, we went to a restaurant tonight, and we had a waiter. So waiting on the Lord means you do what a waiter does. I said, well, what does a waiter do? He said, well, a waiter, he takes our orders, and then he serves us. You know, the more I thought about that, out of the mouth of babes, what does it mean to wait upon the Lord? Waiting upon the Lord means to take his orders and then to serve him. Matter of fact, when you look throughout the Psalms, anytime you see that terminology of waiting upon the Lord, it's always followed by active verbs. I wait and then I act. I wait and then I do. It's never a sense of passivity at all. Because the reality is that, again, God is not a father who's trying to lose his children. He's not a shepherd who's forsaking his sheep. He expects us to take the next natural step in life. Sometimes that means that we have to find a job. We look for a ministry to do instead of waiting for others to pursue us. We find a spouse. We fulfill obligations. We do something, which is exactly, I believe, the lesson that we can learn from Ruth. The reality is that God's sovereignty and human initiative are not in tension. They correspond one to another in a way that only God could bring together. There's a second lesson we can learn, I believe, from Ruth chapter 2. The second lesson is simply this, that God's sovereignty, his providence, is always in accord with his grace. And what do I mean by that? It's just the simple reality that when God moves, he always does so with good intent. He blesses an individual that is ready to take a step of faith. Matter of fact, we see this all throughout the Old Testament. Now, God doesn't bless foolishness, but he does bless faith. He blesses courage. He blesses movers. By faith, Ruth moved out into the field. By providence, she happened to come to Boaz's field. Now, in that field, she met opposition. She encountered hardship. She had to work. She ultimately paused from her labors so that she could rest. And perhaps she even suffered abuse. But she persisted in the path that was before her. And in that path, God met her with grace. Think for a moment. Ruth awoke in the morning, asked Naomi if she could go to the field. In a matter of hours, she went from an illegal alien to a favored maidservant. Within weeks, she'll be a married woman. Within months, she'll be a mother. And the bane of barrenness will be removed. Within generations, she'll be known by her offspring, King David. And within millennium, she'll be placed within the genealogy of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. You know, Ruth didn't know that when she got up that morning. Ruth didn't know that when she walked out into the field. Ruth didn't know that when she started to glean. Ruth didn't know that when she was suffering abuse. But the reality is, based upon the promises of God, that when God moves, he moves in our best interest. It doesn't mean that there won't be hardship. It doesn't mean that there won't be times of barrenness. It doesn't mean that there won't be times of abuse. But God always moves in accordance with his grace. Ruth moved out, and God met her on the way. Risk? Yes. Threats? Absolutely. Challenges? They're always there. But God's promise is to protect, provide, and in Ruth's situation, even to promote. First lesson I think we can learn is that God's sovereignty and man's initiative are not in tension. Second lesson we can learn is simply that God's sovereignty is always in accord with his grace. That gives us confidence as we take steps forward. There's a third lesson to be learned. I think the third lesson is simply this, is that God's sovereignty is at work during times of seeming silence. God's sovereignty is at work during times of seeming silence. Let me say that in a slightly different way. When nothing is happening, something is happening. When nothing is happening, something is happening. What was Ruth doing on this particular day that ultimately changed her life and, from a human perspective, changed the course of history? You know what she was doing? She was going to work. That's where most of us live. Most of us go to work on a daily basis. Most of us fulfill our daily responsibilities, and days and weeks can go by without seeming any distinct movement from God on our behalf. And it's during those times when we can grow discouraged and we can wonder, is God even working on our behalf? Or perhaps God is focusing on the larger things of life. Perhaps God's focus is on the trade wars. Perhaps God's focus is on all the dynamics that are taking place in Africa. Perhaps he's concerned about the significant geopolitical events that are taking place in Europe and in the United States. Perhaps that's what God is focusing on, and he really hasn't had any time to really minister to me, to work on my behalf. Can I simply assure us this morning that God is always working on our behalf, even during times of silence? At times we ponder if our life situation will ever change. Will my spouse become the person that I need them to be? Will my job ever provide true stability for me? Will my children respond to God's work in their lives? And the silence of those questions from God at times is almost deafening. Yet it's important to understand that when nothing is happening, something is always happening. God is actively involved in the day-to-day responsibilities of your life. He is never too busy. He's never concerned about matters outside of you. He, again, is a God who meets us and grows us in the mundane events of our lives, not merely the mountaintop responsibilities. Think for a moment about the book of Acts. Acts covers the first 30 years of church history. Altogether, that's roughly about 11,000 days. And yet, when you actually read the totality of Acts, the story itself covers less than 360 days. So we have to ask ourselves the question, if 30 years are covered from Acts 1 to Acts 28, why is it that we're only given 1 year of activity? What exactly are Peter and Paul doing for the other 29 years? And the reality is, what they're doing is they're rising every morning and they're going about and they're fulfilling their daily responsibilities. The days that are covered are significant days, riots in Ephesus, significant gospel presentations in Athens. But most of the time, what the apostles are doing and what the church is doing is they're simply going to work. And in the process of their going to work, we're told that they turned the world upside down. Friends, this evening, let me tell you that God will turn the world upside down because we fulfill our daily responsibilities. In the mundaneness of life, God is moving. When nothing is happening, something is happening because God is always at work on our behalf to conform us to the image of his Son and to use us to impact the world that's around us. This evening, let me encourage you to take heart when you read Ruth chapter 2. Perhaps your situation is one where you say, I don't have a lot of hope. I've really not heard from God for a while. Number one, take steps of faith-filled initiative. Trust that God will sovereignly and providentially meet you in the way. Don't be paralyzed by inactivity. Serve God wholeheartedly, fully, zealously. You say, I don't even know what to do. Just do the next right thing. Second, believe that God's sovereignty is always in accord with his grace. Be confident that the will of God will never take you where the grace of God cannot keep you and protect you. And then third, be encouraged. Be assured that when nothing is happening, something is happening. God is not resting. God has not forgotten. God's plan for you is an active plan. And just like Ruth, he meets you in the way. He opens the door, and he provides by his grace. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your goodness. Thank you for this little story that encourages us. And Lord, we realize we've only read one scene, just one act. The rest of the story is, again, marked by the provision of your grace, even in the provision of King David, the one who ultimately is the model of your Son. Father, may the story of Ruth encourage us this evening. May it challenge us. May it prompt us to trust you and then to obey your word as we ought. And we'll give you thanks as you would accomplish these things in your name. Amen.